Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. I recently had the pleasure of talking to the Friends of the Richardson Public Library, and as a thank you, the Friends said they would buy whatever book or DVD I chose and put it in the library collection in my name. My choice was a DVD of Russian film director Grigory Kazintsev's Hamlet. I first encountered it in a 16mm version while in grad school. I was fortunate because although the film was made in 1964, because of the Cold War, it remained mostly unseen in the West until it became widely available on DVD in 2006. Samuel Crowell has written about the Kazintsev Hamlet and about the entire genre of Shakespeare on screen. Crowell is professor of literature at Ohio University. He held an observership with the Royal Shakespeare Company and is the author of several books, including Shakespeare Observed and Shakespeare at the Cineplex. Samuel, welcome to Think.
Jerome, pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start with Olivier, with Laurence Olivier's 1948 Hamlet, because it was so important. It remains the only Shakespeare adaptation to win a Best Film Oscar. Correct. And I wanted to ask you about why. I mean, his Henry V, several years before, was a wartime film, made him a national hero. It was this incredibly rousing, full-color epic. But Hamlet is smaller, darker, it's a less expensive film to make, and yet it's still the film that many people think of when they think of Hamlet on screen. Why?
Well, I think it's because of that combination of the great classical actor in Britain just coming into the full sense of his artistic powers and as an actor beginning to learn how to transform Shakespeare from stage to film, even if it doesn't make for all of us the complete journey there. I think part of the reason the Hamlet wins the Academy Award is that the Academy probably felt a little guilty that Henry V hadn't won. Sometimes you get a second chance. I think, too, in my own sense of thinking about the film, that it comes at a ripe moment after the end of the Second World War, of which we often think of Olivier's Henry V as the greatest sort of propaganda film ever made in terms of rallying the English citizens and the troops as they were about to invade France and to carry the war to Hitler, that Shakespeare is a part of what the war was worth winning for. Shakespeare is a part of the Western tradition that got preserved, and Olivier is now the general who is bringing him to the people and bringing him beyond those of us who can make it to the theater to this broader audience that the Henry V film opened up. Because I agree with you that the film is starker, more radical in many ways, not as populist as the Henry V, and yet it was recognized as a remarkable achievement.
I'd like to play a clip from the film. Now, I'm going to play a number of clips during the course of the show, I hope. I've edited them down to about a minute in each case, so for reasons of length. But I wanted to set this up. This is the ghost scene, and I hope we get to hear three different sequences from this. This is when Hamlet, who's been told that his father, who has died, is appearing as a ghost on the parapets of the castle, and so Hamlet has gone up there in the middle of the night to find out for himself. And what you're first going to hear here is Hamlet's heartbeats as he senses the ghost is approaching, or as some would have it, he's imagining he's going to see a ghost. So if we could run clip number one.
Thou a spirit of hell, or goblin damned, thou comest in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee. I'll call thee Hamlet, King, Father, Royal Dane, oh, answer me!
It beckons you to go away with it.
It waves you to a more immovable ground.
But do not go with it.
No, by no means.
It will not speak. Then I will follow it.
What strikes me about that scene, it's a tremendously dramatic scene, as you might imagine. It's the first time we see the ghost. It's this very dark scene. But yet, despite the music, the climax there and the heartbeats, it's a remarkably hushed scene. Olivier's almost whispering his lines, especially when he comes to father. And I found that really quite remarkable, the transition from stage to screen, that Olivier knew he didn't have to employ the grand tragedian voice, that he could instantly go to this more intimate portrayal.
That's a great point, and that's something he did sense about how you bring things down to the camera rather than blow them up as you do on stage. I think it also lets us know that this is going to be a very internalized Hamlet. This is not a political Hamlet. This is a Hamlet that does not try to give us, that is, Olivier's approach to the play and the way in which he shaped it for the screen is not a political epic. It's a very personal, private family drama. And it's that internalization that he wants to get from the beginning. And if you'll remember, Jerome, when he then pursues the ghost further on, and when the ghost lets him know what Claudius has in fact done, it wipes him out. I mean, he sprawls on the parapet. He's brought, in a sense, he's leveled by this astounding news. That is, the power of the father here is exceedingly evident, although Olivier's sort of shift in attention is going to be turning to the mother and to Gertrude and to highlight their relationship. But you're absolutely right about the way in which he, from the outset, internalizes that ghost and internalizes in the heartbeat, because I take it that the heartbeat starts with the ghost and then is transferred. That is, it's something that Olivier's Hamlet system picks up and beats back with, because, and you're probably going to go there at some point, in the closet, the famous closet scene, when Hamlet is abusing Gertrude about her relationship with Claudius and the ghost reappears. It's absolutely incredible how the major artery in Olivier's neck reverberates with that same beat of the ghost's heartbeat. And I have no idea, actually, how they accomplished that filmically.
Oh, I had never noticed that, actually. That's really kind of amazing. I hadn't considered that as a possibility. It's strange, I think, for many people who might see the Olivier Hamlet now. One generation's realistic portrayal is the next generation's horrible affectation. Olivier now can come across as rather stagey, very romantic, a kind of matinee idol in some ways.
Yes, isn't it remarkable? Because Olivier's Hamlet was staking him off from Gielgud. That is, even though Gielgud was roughly a contemporary, it was Gielgud who was the dreamy, romantic, melancholy intellectual. And Olivier's Hamlet, particularly when he did it on the stage with Tyrone Guthrie, one of the great British critics, James Agate, wrote that this was the best performance of Hotspur he'd ever seen in Hamlet. Okay, and I think Olivier was also trying to tone that down a bit in the film, that is, not wanting to make his Hamlet too naturally realistic and athletic, which are two of Olivier's great qualities. And then you're right. Now, for my students, this is passé. This is a style of speaking Shakespeare that is out of tune with them. They're all in the camp of somebody like Kenneth Branagh. He speaks Shakespeare to them. He's closer to their generation. He's more what they think Shakespeare sounds like than when they hear Olivier. And so I get the happy a task as a professor of reminding them of what the great strengths of Olivier's film really are.
Well, seeing as you bring up Branagh, well, let's go to his Hamlet from 1996. And one of the things you write about in the Norton Guide, Shakespeare and Film, which I recommend to anyone, is an excellent introduction to the entire field. You talk about early on something that as a theater critic of the Dallas Morning News I often encountered, and that is that even today, for many people, the way you judge an adaptation of Shakespeare on screen is how much Shakespeare it puts in it. And in other words, how many lines are included. And Olivier caught grief for that because he chopped out whole chunks. As you said, he removed a lot of the political things about what was going on in Elsinore, and he removed all of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in order to concentrate on the psychology, although it's also to concentrate on Hamlet, the star, as it were. But Branagh makes the choice to include absolutely everything, and so he produces a four-hour Hamlet that includes every single line in Shakespeare. And you call this the fidelity model. I was wondering if you'd talk about that.
Yeah, in many ways, the fidelity model doesn't work. That is, you have to shape your own film, your own approach. It's the film that has to be great, not your fidelity to the original work. You could be absolutely faithful to every word and produce a dull film. You could also do something as radical as, let's say, Michael Almereyda's film of Hamlet, which is even cuts more of the text than Olivier's does, and produces a very interesting take on the play. I think that, and it's curious, you make a wonderful point, when we first started writing about Shakespeare in film, most of us were Shakespeareans. We were trained in English departments, and we loved film, and we began to see that the Shakespeare films were better than our professors had thought they were when we maybe first encountered them, and we began to champion in them. And we began to run up against this notion of the fidelity model. Well, they cut this and they cut that. What happened was that when Branagh's Hamlet came out, he got attacked for following the complete text. Doesn't he know that he really ought to cut, that he hasn't shaped the film? But I think Branagh was after giving us the whole thing. That is, he knew what an impossible task that was. And he knew he was blowing up a whole series of cinematic conventions, i.e. particularly length, that we're willing to put our bottoms in the seats to see a movie. But he wanted, for his own purposes, to give us the full text. And I think he wanted to do that not as a criticism of Olivier, but as an alternative to it, because he really stresses the epic sense of the play. Most of us were raised on Olivier, raised in our own Freudian psychoanalytic, at least psychological era, where our attention is on the prince more than on the play. And what Branagh did was show us what a powerful political play this was by setting it against both a moment of political upheaval in Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century, coupled with what had just happened in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Iron Curtain. So I think he brought us back to parts of the play that go beyond just the prince. And if the film has a real contribution to make to the continuing dialogue about Shakespeare and film, that's it.
One of the things, it's easy to see Branagh's Hamlet as a counter to Olivier's, because as we mentioned earlier, Olivier's was a relatively low-budget film. It's in black and white. It's all studio shot. And Branagh's is after Dr. Zhivago. He's yes. going over the big Hollywood epic. It's this sumptuous film. And I'm afraid we're going to have to take a break right now, but we'll come back to discussing Branagh's Hamlet and eventually the Kaczyntsev Hamlet. Our guest today is Samuel Crowell, an expert on Shakespeare on film. And if you wish to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Samuel Crowell, scholar on Shakespeare on Film, and we're discussing Hamlet on Film. And just before the break, we brought up the Kenneth Branagh 1996 Hamlet as something of a counter to Olivier's 1948 Hamlet. And I wanted to play a clip. This is the same exact scene we played earlier. Hamlet is gone to see his father's ghost. And in this case, Branagh has gone outside the castle and is during this entire sequence is sort of racing through a forest. This is the same speech, same scene. But remember how hushed Olivier's was.
Angels and ministers of grace, defend us. Be thou a spirit of health or goblin damned. Bring with thee airs from heaven or blast from hell. Be thy intents wicked or charitable. Thou com'st in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee. I'll call thee Hamlet, king, father, royal Dane. Or answer me! Let me not burst in ignorance, but tell why thy canonized bones, hersed in death, have burst their cerements. Why, the sepulchre wherein we saw thee quietly inurned have oped his ponderous and marble jaws to cast thee up again. What may this mean? That thou, dead corpse, again, in complete steel, revisits thus the glimpses of the moon, making night hideous, and we, fools of nature, so horridly to shake our dispositions with thoughts beyond the reaches of our souls. Say, why is this? Wherefore? What should we do?
Whither wilt thou lead me? Speak. I'll go no further.
Mark me.
It's a wonderful contrast between the heartbeats in the first and Branagh's breathing in the second. We should note that in that entire sequence, there are dozens of jump cuts that as we see him running through the forest, anytime he mentions something like blasts from hell, we'll see an explosion from the ground, or he mentions his father's corpse, we'll see the father's corpse. So there's a real sort of literal visualization of everything he's speaking about.
Yes, he has mentioned to me that that is the one segment of the film he wished he'd had a chance to revisit and had had the funds to do properly. He wanted it to be terrifying, and the special effects, as you point out, just don't work, and they don't terrify us. In fact, what does terrify us, it seems to me, is that incredible face of Brian Blessed and those huge bloodshot blue eyes staring at us, often in close-up, or a close-up of just even one eye, that Blessed as the ghost brings the terror to the moment much more than the prototechnics or pyrotechnics, I guess they're both, that Branagh as a filmmaker tries to bring. But you also hear, getting back to the nice point you made earlier about Olivier, Branagh really wants to give us all that language. He's not afraid of it, and he wants to spit it out in a way that is powerful and at this moment also indicating the way in which he is mesmerized and frightened by this moment. And I think it goes a long way to that the tack he takes with the character, which is not someone who we might imagine would not make a very good king. Branagh wants to be the king. Branagh thinks that his prince would make, as Fortinbras says, would approve most royally had he been put on.
He's not so emo as Olivier's Hamlet is. But I couldn't help but think that in making this kind of Hollywood epic, that Branagh wants an audience that can follow all that language. And so he does make this very concerted effort to try and explain things, as it were, visually, so that we can follow it. He's after the sort of 14-year-old moviegoer.
I think you're absolutely right. That's, of course, who we found in Henry V and then capitalized on in Much Ado About Nothing. And I think he was after them again. He didn't get them this time around. And there is something, as he sets the film in the late Victorian or early Edwardian period, there's something of a sort of big Victorian scrapbook or illustrated volume that the film provides us with. And it becomes many times visual overload. But I still think that the task that he set himself was a remarkable one, to get all that language, to get that whole story told in a way that he thought, as you say, would be powerful to an audience who were not going because their teachers had sent them.
Let's go to a caller now. Clark from Westford. You have a question about the Olivier Hamlet?
Yes. When I was a young boy, I was born in 43, and my aunt took me to see the Olivier Hamlet. Hello?
Yes. Go on.
And the scene that stuck in my head forever and ever and ever is the one where Ophelia is going down the stream. She's got flowers all around her. Apparently, as I know now, she committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, the movie was in color, right?
No. Yes. The,
it wasn't?
Oh, no, it was black and white.
The Olivier is black and white.
I grew up in black and white, so I guess I imagine it being in color. And she was surrounded by flowers, and I wondered, who was the actress that played Olivier? I mean, excuse me, Ophelia.
Jerome, do you want to answer this one?
Hang on. I actually have that information right
here. It's Gene Simmons.
Gene Simmons.
Yes.
Right.
Oh,
it was her second film role. She had been in David Lean's Great Expectations. And right. That scene that you mentioned, sir, is wonderful because Olivier took it from a famous painting of Ophelia done by a Pre-Raphaelite by the name of Millet, which is a color. I mean, it is painting.
You may have seen. My grandmother's sister was named Ophelia. and that stuck in my head forever and ever. And that seems very, I think it's very germane to the whole story.
Oh, yes.
Okay, I'll let off now and let you guys continue your discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. That is the famous Millet of the kind of Victorian woman in her full dress, sort of floating, soaked in flowers. And yes, it's one of clearly Olivier's quotations.
Exactly.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that Branagh, conversely, is unashamed of quoting Hollywood films. That he's well versed when he makes this Henry V, a very violent, very gritty sort of films. He watched war movies in order to figure out how to shoot those battle scenes.
That is correct. I mean, that's what Branagh brings to the Shakespeare film. Baz Luhrmann picks right up on it and takes it to another level. But he was the first, I think, of the Shakespeare on film people, particularly someone coming out of the British tradition, even though he's Northern Irish, to be unafraid to adopt popular cinematic conventions to the Shakespeare film. And when he succeeds, he produces something that, as you indicated before, can reach a wide audience.
Now, in your book, you talk about the Olivier and the Branagh as representing these kind of two waves of Shakespeare adaptations that we had in the 40s through the 60s, up to Zeffirelli's, you know, hugely popular Romeo and Juliet. Then they die out. Branagh brings them back in the late 80s, early 90s, and we had this other wave. And I was wondering if you could talk about why. I mean, for many of us, it seems sort of odd that they just kind of vanished for 20 years, and then they come back. So what happened?
I think several things happened. One was the Shakespeare films that came out immediately after Zeffirelli's blockbuster Romeo and Juliet in 68, which made more money than any other Shakespeare film up to its time. One was Roman Polanski's Macbeth that people thought was going to be a big winner at the box office and was not. And another film, which you greatly admire, and I do too, but particularly when I was younger, Peter Brook's King Lear, which was very stark, very Brechtian, not a film that was...
And I don't think anyone was expecting it to be a box office
exactly.
hit.
You're absolutely right. But I think it wasn't even a critical mm-hmm. hit where people talked about it. Okay. And then about at the same time, this is the early 70s, the BBC announced that they were going to do, that is the BBC Television mm-hmm. Corporation, were going to do the complete canon of Shakespeare's plays on television. And so with the fact that the Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet didn't produce follow-up films that were successful, the suits, the money people, the Hollywood guys began to say, well, if the Shakespeareans are getting their Shakespeare free on television 4 or 5 times a year from these BBCs, why should we invest any money in films? And so it was even the case with Branagh's 89 Henry V that not a penny of film industry money was in that film. A man who had come to see Henry V, had never met Branagh before, went backstage, said, "I'm Stephen Evans and I work in the city. This is Wall Street in London. And, I thought your performance, this was on stage, was terrific. Is there any way I can be of help in future projects you might have in mind?" And Branagh said, "You could help me raise some money to make a film of Henry V." And this man did. But every penny of the money came from private investors and not from the cinema industry. And then that film was a great critical success. It made its money back commercially, although it wasn't any quasi-blockbuster. And then it got nominated for, three or four Academy Awards. And that opened the door. Zeffirelli was already working on the Hamlet, but that opened the door for the Much Ado About Nothing, which followed and was a commercial success. And then Baz Luhrmann came along with his Romeo and Juliet, and suddenly Shakespeare was hot.
You're saying, in essence, what accounts for these waves is box office. Either succeeding or failing at the box office provides the influence. And it seems to me that you can also see the difference between sort of art house and mainstream, that as long as these tend to be sort of low to medium budget films aimed at an art house audience, they often can succeed. And then they sometimes surprise you. They suddenly go big. And so Hollywood wants in on the action. And then the films don't work out as well. And we're back to trying to scrabble together a couple of million to produce an art house film. Is that
fair? Absolutely right. Absolutely right, Jerome. Because this little revolution in the 1990s of Shakespeare films came along just as the revolution in what became known as the indies, the independent films, the films that were, if not made by, were distributed by places like Miramax. And they began to pick up awards. The industry itself began to see that a film that was made, when the average price of a film was $60 to $80 million, that some of these films made for 10 to 15, if they simply doubled their money or tripled their money, even though that was only a total box office of 45, that was as big a gain as a movie that you invested 80 in that only made 20 or 30 on top of it. So that was sort of the independent film a decade. And not only did we get a lot of Shakespeare's, but we got all of Jane Austen's novels redone for film. We got four Henry James novels done for film. It was a sort of, I think when we look back, that is those of us who like film, but also like film that works with some interesting literary material, we'll see it as a real golden era at the end of the 20th century.
And now I'd like to turn to the film that started all this, and a film that didn't have to worry about box office so much because it was made in the Soviet Union in the 60s, and that is the Kaczynski Hamlet. I'd like to set up this clip. What you're going to hear first is the carousing of King Claudius, Hamlet's stepfather, and then we're going to cut to Hamlet and his guards on the castle walls in a windstorm, and they all too see the ghost. And Hamlet then follows after the ghost, and what you hear are horses panicked, crashing out of a stable as they see the ghost come by. And then Hamlet follows the ghost along the walls until finally they come to the cliff overlooking the ocean. You'll hear the waves, and Hamlet says again, "Stop." So this is the same sequence as the previous two, the Kaczynski of Hamlet.
Смотрите, принц! Вот он!
Святитель небесный, спасите!
Он подал знак!
This is all in black and white photography with the ghost as a giant suit of black armor. He looks like Darth Vader.
Куда ведешь? Я дальше не пойду.
Следи за мной.
Слежу.
Доверься мне и выслушай.
Every time I watch that, it still raises the hairs on my arms. To see this huge tank-like armor, and all of a sudden you hear this kind of murmuring voice coming out of it is really quite a surprise. I have edited that down. The sequence is actually longer than that. Where they walk along the parapets, and Hamlet, terrified, is following after this monster. It's an amazing sequence, and it is shot in the kind of black and white that you'd see in Orson Welles' Citizen Kane.
Right. The film also does its homage to Olivier in the sense of that sea pounding on the rocks beneath the castle, which Olivier uses particularly in the To Be or Not to Be sequence. But it's bigger and it's more powerful, and that Shostakovich score is just wonderful. And it also has that political sense. The Claudius in this film is a very powerful, squat, bull-like man that is a real opponent, as opposed, I think, to Basil Sidney's Claudius in Olivier's
film. No, he's a real presence. The actor is a real presence. He's this real threatening figure, and he's a wonderful villain. And one of the things I thought was, I had never realized this, one of the things that's most striking about your discussion of the Kazints of Hamlet is how you see this as a reflection on Stalin, that the entire film is as a kind of metaphor about being trapped in the Soviet state.
Yeah, the film was made in the thaw when Khrushchev took over post-Stalin, and I think it released Kozintsev to be able to present at least some images of what life had been like under Stalin without directly saying so. And Shakespeare was always used by Eastern European stage and film producers as a way to smuggle in subversive ideas that they could not have done directly with a contemporary text.
We're talking to Samuel Krall, an expert on Shakespeare on film, and we'll be back after this. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd, and we're talking to Samuel Krall about Hamlet on film. And we were discussing Kazintsev, the great Russian 1964 film version of Hamlet. We played a little clip from it. And I had mentioned that I saw the distinct influence of Orson Welles and the deep focus, jet black photography, beautiful photography. But Boo in Dallas brings up another influence that you also mentioned. That's Akira Kurosawa, the great Japanese director, and his adaptation, The Bad Sleep Well. So one of you talk about the Kurosawa film and its influence.
Well, Kurosawa is in The Bad Sleep Well takes the Hamlet story into modern Tokyo, post-war Tokyo, and recasts it within commercial capitalist world that is emerging, and it's filled with Kurosawan effects. It's the least of your caller is very alert to see it as a Shakespeare spinoff, and it is a Hamlet spinoff, just coming into the modern world the way Throne of Blood takes us back into samurai Japan. Kurosawa and Kozintsev did correspond. They did were much aware of each other's work, but it's interesting. I'm going to have to go back and look at The Bad Sleep Well again and think about it in terms of the Kozintsev.
Mm-hmm. The contrast amongst the three clips that we played, the Olivier, the Branagh, and the Kozintsev, The Olivier, of course, being very hushed. The Branagh being, directly yells the speech, this very muscular sort of approach. And the Kaczynski, in which there's almost no speaking. There's very little dialogue. And that Shostakovich score is just so powerful. You write about, and I think people could write whole dissertations on just this use of scores in the Shakespeare adaptations. In addition to the Kaczynski, the Shostakovich, William Walton's score for Hamlet and Henry V for Olivier, they have been played in concert halls and symphonies. And there's the famous Nina Rota theme from Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, which became a huge pop hit by Henry Mancini. But the Shostakovich it's kind of hard to argue against that score. It is such a powerful presence in the film, equal to, I think, to the cinematography.
Now, one of the things when we think about film, when we think about Shakespeare on film, is the role of the film score, which we just aren't, is not a part of the theatrical world. We don't go into the theater and go to a production of Shakespeare expecting there to be a rich score that either punctuates scenes or actually comes in under the text. And there is a lot of argument about this, about whether you want two kinds of music working either with or against each other, the music of Shakespeare's poetry and the music of a fine film score. But it's also one of the conventions of film. We are used to having that music both overpower us, but also sometimes subtly get under our skins in ways we're not quite aware, as it points us to the way in which we ought to be thinking, feeling, being alert to. And the Shostakovich and the Walton are two just terrific examples of that. And I would add, I keep coming back to being a sort of champion of the Branagh team, that Patrick Doyle scores for Branagh's films have that same power. And once again, as Branagh's speaking of the language appealed to the young, I was amazed when I walked into the school kids' record store in Athens, Ohio, back in the early 1990s, when this was a place you went to buy hardcore rock and roll, and on the speaker system was the score, Doyle's score for Henry V. And I went to the back of the record store to say, what's going on? The kid said, I love this. Isn't this great? So there was something also about that music of Doyle that spoke to the generation that Branagh was making his films for.
The Shostakovich presence on the Kaczynski also lends credence to your theory about it's a buried commentary on Stalin, because of Shostakovich's own tensions with Stalin. It really does make the thing much more of a political statement. I was surprised to learn when I was researching the film, I had always assumed that unlike the Olivier, unlike the Branagh, the Kaczynski was shot on location, that they had found some decrepit old castle somewhere. And yet it is a set that I understand. They built that huge thing in Estonia somewhere.
That's right. But it's a very different castle than Olivier's. Olivier's castle is, of course, a studio set, and it is an empty castle. It's a castle of the mind. It's a castle of Hamlet's internal state of mind. It's a film noir castle. Kaczynski's castle is a working castle, and there are peasants walking around there, and there are animals, and there are those men who, with great strength and great effort, roll up the drawbridge after Hamlet's horse trots over it as he is coming back from Germany for his father's funeral or his mother's marriage, and we get immediately that image as that drawbridge slowly rises and closes of Denmark's a prison. I mean, that is, he is ridden into some place. He will leave only once, and when he does return, we get that lovely shot outside of the castle walls down along the breakaway by the sea of the solitary seagull in the sky, and whether the seagull is Ophelia or the soul or freedom or whatever. It's something that Hamlet is not going to be able to enjoy, his own freedom. He has to return inside that castle to finally confront Claudius.
I'm going to turn to another caller from Dallas, a very patient person. Thank you for waiting. David, do you have a question?
Yes. Years and years ago in the 70s, my German teacher referenced a German version of Hamlet in which instead of being in, you know, the king of Denmark and whatnot. Hamlet's father was an industrialist who has died, and I believe it was called The Rust of Silence. Are you familiar with this work, and could you discuss it at all?
Thank you very much.
Samuel? I missed the title.
The Rest is Silence.
No, I do not know that work. I'm sorry, I can't. I can't make any comment other than we see with the example of the Kurosawa, with the example of the Almereyda Hamlet, that there is a way in which the Hamlet story seems to fit into the corporate structure, and it's a way in which when we translate the story from its moment in English or Danish history into our own world, where we don't have the same sort of power arrangements politically, it seems to fit very neatly into the corporate structure. And I would go back. This would give me a chance to make a segue that I wanted to make earlier, and that is we've done all this ghost work very nicely, I think, and I don't want to leave out one of the most powerful ghosts in Hamlet films, which is the great playwright Sam Shepard, who plays the ghost in the Almereyda Hamlet, and in that corporate...
The Ethan Hawke Hamlet, as some people
exactly.
can think of it.
That's right. In that corporate structure, Claudius is the head of the Denmark Corporation, which is a major Time Warner sort of outfit that is into all sorts of media outlets. And the fact that Shepard, who is the true artist, the true... dramatist plays the ghost as Ethan Hawke's Hamlet is trying to be his own sort of radical filmmaker is just a lovely little twist.
I have to confess, I have never heard of The Rest is Silence as a German adaptation of Hamlet. I'm curious. I'm going to have to go try and look that up in some way.
Me too. There is a German Hamlet, but it's Maximilian Schell,
which is a horrible Hamlet.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Mystery Science Theater 3000 has fun with that. Has a lot of fun with that. It's a very 60s Hamlet, very sort of self-consciously experimental, and unfortunately.
And there's a Finnish Hamlet by a man named. Kosmogzaki. Anyway, it's called Hamlet Goes Business, and it's sort of a takeoff on Hamlet. And the, once again, it's a modern corporate world, and what Claudius and the corporation make are little rubber duckies, and that's the source of the little rubber ducky in the Ethan Hawke Hamlet. That's part of the little of the gifts that Ophelia is giving back to him in the
scene. Oh, so it's a little in joke.
Yes.
Well, speaking of corporate. I wanted to turn to someone who's not Hamlet. So much attention is given to the actor portraying Hamlet, and people often identify the film not even by the directors, but by the actor's name, the Mel Gibson Hamlet, rather than the Zeffirelli. And yet there are some film performances that nearly steal the film from Hamlet. And this next clip is from the Richard Burton Hamlet, which is not well known because it's actually a videotaped performance of his Broadway run, directed by John Gielgud. This is Hume Cronyn, the great character actor. He spent, you know, decades in Hollywood, but he was beloved on stage. This is when he won his first Tony Award, was for this. He's playing Polonius, and he's confronting his daughter, Ophelia, about her treatment, her goings-on with Hamlet. And this is a plain dress, a kind of street dress version of Hamlet. It's often called the rehearsal Hamlet, because it's just bare stage with a few wooden platforms, and people are in street clothes. And Cronyn has been playing Polonius as a kind of effective but a bit officious character, a businessman, a manager. But this is when we finally see him in a family mode, and he comes across as a pretty nasty piece of work. So this is Hume Cronyn as Polonius.
He's told me he had very oft of late given private time to you, and you yourself have of your audience been most free and bounteous. If it be so, as so does put on me, and that by way of caution, I must tell you, you do not understand yourself so clearly as behooves my daughter and your honor. What is between you? Give me up the truth.
He hath, my lord, of late made many tenders of his affection to me.
Affection? You speak like a green girl unsifted by such perilous circumstance. Do you believe his tenders, as you call them?
I do not know, my lord, what I should think.
Honey, I'll teach you. Think yourself a baby that you obtain these tenders for true pay, which are not sterling. Tender yourself more dearly, or you'll tender me a fool.
My lord, he hath importuned me with love in honorable fashion.
Aye, springes to catch woodcocks. I do know when the blood burns how prodigal the soul lends the tongue vows. These blazes, daughter, you must not take for fire.
This is a man interrogating his daughter and mocking her viciously. It's an amazing performance because Hume Cronyn is also very, very funny in it. You do not include the Burton Hamlet in your book, Shakespeare and Film, and I was wondering why.
Well, now that you've pointed that out, I'll have to do a second edition. No, I didn't, because process that they used, something called electronovision, was one that didn't take hold. This was maybe going to be a route, which we're coming back to now with things the Metropolitan Opera doing and the National Theater in Britain. But this was a way of recording live performances of great stage productions and then making them available through theatrical release. And so it falls in a no man's land between either television on one hand or film on the other. Though I remember liking it immensely when I was in graduate school. It's when I saw it. And I liked it for the very reason I was sort of pointing to some of the reason I like Branagh, is that I thought Burton was a very virile Hamlet. And my Hamlet is not the melancholy, deeply introspective. He's sensitive and he's smart, but I like a Hamlet that has some virility in him. And it's because he is both virile and has a conscience that he is troubled. That's what is the pull, that when he's asked by the ghost to be an avenger, which works against his conscience. I mean, it isn't, you know, he wants to be able to be it. Is it not perfect conscience if I do not quit him with this arm? He wants to be able to be a murderer who's unsoiled, and that's a very tough thing to accomplish.
And I think Burton really has the kind of matinee idol quality that Olivier did, of course, too. But you can't take your eyes off him when he's on stage. And he's also has that very quiet, because he has such a rich voice. It doesn't take much from him to command attention. And it really
An interesting little bit we shouldn't let go by. When Olivier made his Hamlet, he wanted to... Oh, here comes the music. Anyway, the same actress plays Gertrude in Olivier's Hamlet, who then played it again in 64 in the Burton Hamlet.
Oh, that is a nice connection.
Eileen Hurley.
Our guest has been Samuel Crowell, an expert on Shakespeare on film. We've been discussing Hamlet in particular. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and Lindsay Knecht. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. We had help on the phones today from Addie Sun. I'd also like to thank Premier Video. And you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Thanks very much, Sam. Once again, I'm Jerome Weeks. I'm in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.